Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Midterm campaigns in high gear this week. Britain cuts, France riots. Don't Ask, Don't Tell is off and on again, and NPR fires Juan Williams. The president hit the West looking to pump up support here in Portland, Oregon.
There's always somebody out there saying, no, you can't. But in 2 weeks, you've got a chance to say, yes, we can.
Sarah Palin hit the trail, too, to say she smells victory here in Harry Reid's Nevada.
Tea Party Americans, you're winning. You're winning. And the left, they just don't know what the heck to do with you.
And a storm over NPR's firing of news analyst Juan Williams. Here he is last night with Bill O'Reilly.
They were looking for a reason to get rid of me because I appear on Fox News.
That's right.
They don't want me
talking
to you.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Jonathan Martin of Politico, Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. Is Congress about to flip GOP? Is that the right medicine? What do you say on Don't Ask, Don't Tell? And what about NPR, Fox News, and Juan Williams? Oh, boy. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I should say there are a pile of comments there already on the Juan Williams firing, and we will talk about that in this hour, but our two guests have been out on the trail. We want to hear what they've been hearing and seeing. Jonathan Martin, tell us, where have you been? What have you seen? You've been there when Sarah Palin was making her pitch.
Well, thanks for having me. I was with Governor Palin last weekend in California. I did a West Coast swing. I saw the Nevada Senate debate on Thursday. I was with former President Clinton and Jerry Brown Friday in L.A. and then saw Governor Palin in Orange County on Saturday. So it was a good three-day a taste of what's happening on the campaign trail. I was struck at Palin's event by just how national her message and how disconnected it was from the two marquee races there in California for Senate and for governor. You know, Meg Whitman running for governor, Carly Fiorina running for Senate. The very high-profile contest. Both candidates have gotten a lot of national buzz, yet she didn't mention either candidate in her speech, and neither candidate themselves was there.
What's that about, Jonathan?
Well, I think it illustrates the danger of having Palin at an event in a place like California if you are a statewide GOP hopeful trying to corral centrist votes. She simply does not help that cause because she turns off a lot of voters in the middle, and so the candidates don't want to be seen with her. And I think she may have not mentioned them in part because she was trying to be helpful to them and not give their Democratic opponents more fodder. But it was striking, though, to have this event taking place in California days before the election and have really no mention or reference to the fact that there are these high-profile statewide contests going on.
That's pretty wild. Karen Tumulty, you've been out and about a lot. What are you seeing? Are you feeling a GOP / Tea Party tidal wave? Something else? What, Karen?
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be back. Well, I think what we're feeling is the dynamic that's been here all year. I've been in California last week. I was in Texas before that, Wisconsin before that. Nobody doubts there is a wave out there. The question is, how big is this wave? And, you know, how high are the seawalls that individual Democratic candidates have built with they're generally what has been until quite recently a monetary advantage.
But not now. We've got a lot of money coming in heavy and late from who knows where.
That's right. And, that is one of the new wrinkles, I think, this year. There have always been, groups out there that have been able to run ads in elections without naming their donors. But there were restrictions on that there in terms of, you know, how directly they could come after a candidate. Those have all been lifted in part because of a couple of decisions by the Supreme Court. And I think in part because people feel like the stakes are so high in this election that a lot of people who maybe would have been on the sidelines in past elections have decided to get in and write big checks.
Karen, in terms of policy, in terms of message, what's working for and against Republicans, Tea Partiers? What's working for and against Democrats?
Well, You know, it's interesting. I think that it is the Republicans are promising change. But in a lot of ways, you see, though they have an agenda out there, it has been criticized maybe as not as specific as it should have been. I actually don't hear a lot of Republican candidates running on that agenda. Basically, what you hear them talking about is that they will stop the Obama agenda. So that is basically what you have going on their side. The Democrats have attempted to argue that Obama's policies, their policies are working if they would be given more time. But that also is not working. So what they're really trying to do at this point is they have turned very hard negative in their own ads, and they are essentially trying to paint their opponents as unacceptable extremists.
Let's hear a little bit of what's going on out there. Here from the Pennsylvania Senate debate. This is on Wednesday. Republican Pat Toomey up against former General Joe Sestak for Sestak's spending votes in the House of Representatives. Here's Pat Toomey.
Joe Sestak voted against over 100 consecutive efforts to strip out some of the most egregiously wasteful earmarks, including even $2 million for Charlie Rangel's monument to himself. We're never going to get budgets under control when members of Congress keep piling on pork like that and voting for everyone else's pork.
So there's the attack on Sestak in Pennsylvania. Former President Bill Clinton is out and around a lot right now, stumping for Democrats. This week, he was supporting Patty Murray's reelection bid in Washington State. Here's a bit of his standard stump speech where he goes after Republicans. Clinton said President Obama and the Democrats have done the best they can, given that they inherited a recession that began turning around in mid-2009.
Since then, the U.S. has recovered 70% of our lost income. 70% recovery is better than our competitors, but all the new jobs are in the last 30%. And when we get out of this hole, then we're going into the 21st century in the way we should. The worst thing you could do right now is to bring back the shovel brigade and start digging the hole again. We want to quit digging.
Shovels here, shovels there, shovel ready, not shovel ready. Jack Beatty, what do you see in the polling numbers this week?
Well, a very striking Gallup poll. Only 21% of Americans satisfied with the direction of the economy. That's even lower than it was in 1994 when the Republicans won 52 seats. Now, if that's a predictor, they're going to win that many this year. Forecasts seem to be 49 to 55. Academic models say 52, 53. This week, Nate Silver, The Times, their numbers guy, gives the 75% chance of winning the House, 49 seats for the GOP, 17% chance of winning the Senate. And the key variable, of course, and we've talked about it all season long, is the passion. It's on the Republican side. Here in New Hampshire, 50% of Republicans are, quote, extremely interested in voting in this election, whereas only 39% of Democrats and 31% of independents are. And that independent mark, I think, is indicative throughout the country that these ads from both sides are so negative, they're driving independents away. Their enthusiasm about voting is very little, and it's become then a base election in both senses of the word.
Whose ads, Jack? Tea Party ads, Republican ads, Democratic ads?
All ads. I think all ads, all negative ads are really driven to just to do two things: get out the base and drive down independent voters. And that's what's happening in New Hampshire. We're having a blizzard of negative ads. I haven't seen a positive ad from anybody. And it's reflected in the polls where so few independents want to vote.
You want to hear just how negative and maybe weird it can get? Here's the from Kentucky Democratic Senate candidate Jack Conway has put out this ad attacking the Tea Party favorite Republican opponent Rand Paul, going back to Paul's college days and accusing Rand Paul from some kind of a society he was a member of then of defaming Christianity. Here's an excerpt.
Why was Rand Paul a member of a secret society that called the Holy Bible a hoax that was banned for mocking Christianity and Christ? Why did Rand Paul once tie a woman up, tell her to bow down before a false idol, and say his God was Aqua Buddha?
Aqua Buddha. Jonathan Martin, does that work?
Oh, I think it has shaken up the race. Look, the Kentucky Senate race to me is very reminiscent of the Tennessee contest 4 years ago. And bear with me here. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of your listeners will recall this race. That was the Harold Ford contest.
Right.
Perhaps the most high-profile.
Call me Harold. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. You had a race there where you had a strong Democrat running in a conservative-leaning state. And that race went down to the wire. It was always competitive. The National Party stayed in the whole time. But most folks watching the race thought, ultimately, the Democrat would fall a few points short. And sure enough, Ford got the expected 48% on election day. I think Conway in Kentucky sees himself in a similar territory. If he didn't do something to shake this race up, he was destined for 47-48%. This is his haymaker. This is his way of trying to sort of get out of that box. I'm not sure how it ultimately plays. It's going to be very tough for a Democrat to win in Kentucky this year. But if I could just real fast.
Yes.
Because you played the Bill Clinton soundbite, I've been so struck by this. And there was a great piece today in Karen's paper, The Washington Post, mm-hmm. about Bill Clinton that reminded me. And it says something about the state of the Democratic Party and also about President Clinton's enduring popularity that 10 years after he left the Oval Office, he is still so in demand on the campaign trail and essential on the campaign trail. Just imagine, guys, for a minute, 1998, for example, George H.W. Bush being the key go-to surrogate for the GOP. It's implausible. But yet, there is Clinton out there everywhere you see him, East Coast to West Coast.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Campaign fever, don't ask, don't tell, off and on again. NPR kicks up a storm, firing news analyst Juan Williams. Jack Beatty's here. Karen Tumbledy's with us from The Washington Post. National political correspondent there. Jonathan Martin, senior political writer at Politico, is here. And who'd have thunk it that NPR would somehow blow up in the middle of the news this week off of comments made on Monday by longtime NPR analyst Juan Williams. He was fired this week after these comments on Monday night on the Bill O'Reilly Show, which were taken to be anti-Muslim. Here we go.
I mean, look, Bill, I'm not a bigot. You know the kind of books I've written about the civil rights movement in this country. But when I get on a plane, I got to tell you, if I see people who are in Muslim garb, and I think, you know, they're identifying themselves first and foremost as Muslims, I get worried. I get nervous.
And here's NPR CEO Vivian Schiller expressing her take on the rationale behind NPR's decision to fire Juan Williams.
This action was not anti-Fox. This action was pro-journalistic standards, and a news analyst cannot continue credibly to analyze the news if they are expressing opinions about divisive issues. It's that simple. And the same would go with anybody. We're not picking on Juan.
Okay, there's Juan Williams. He said more. We can talk about that. Vivian Schiller said more. Jonathan, Karen, Jack, we've got a lot of reaction from our listeners here. Here's Zeno says, Juan Williams was just expressing what most Americans feel. Victor says, if Juan Williams would have said, when I get on the subway and there are blacks and Latinos in the urban garb, it makes me nervous, his firing would not be defended by anyone outside the Fox fringe. Ellis says, Juan Williams' ordeal is a non-story. News outlet fires subpar commentator for offensive comments on a TV show. Move on. Boy, I don't know. Karen, would you have fired him?
You know, first of all, I don't know anyone who thinks Juan Williams is a bigot. And if you look at the full context of his comments, he points out to the kinds of reporting that he did on the civil rights movement. I suspect that this was kind of, and judging from some of the comments that came out of NPR about how this was not about just this incident, I suspect this was a situation that was sort of an accident waiting to happen, that NPR was sort of looking for some reason to pull the trigger because they were getting more and more uncomfortable with Juan Williams and sort of getting into the fray the way he has on Fox. And you do watch it, and he does take a somewhat different demeanor, say, than Mara Liasson, another NPR personality mm-hmm. reporter in her case, who really does more of a kind of analytical bent.
Is it clear where the line is anymore? Is it clear to you, Karen? Does each news organization have to figure it out? Can we as the news media, whatever that is today, see a bright line here or not?
You know, it's really hard these days because so many of us are out there on so many different platforms at the same time. And so, you know, when I got into journalism, I was a Los Angeles Times reporter. I mean, basically, that was my identity. Mm-hmm. And so many of us now have identities outside the news organizations that we work for, and yet everything we do and say reflects on the news organizations that we work for. And it's a balance that I think all of us are sort of trying to figure out.
Jonathan Martin, there is something like a firestorm out there right now. Is that justified or not? Is the firing justified or not? How do you see it?
Oh, I think this episode perfectly illustrates the sort of politico media world that we live in now. Two of my friends and colleagues, John Harris and Mark Halperin, wrote a book in 2006, and they call it The Freak Show. And this really captured it. Well, you've got Fox, you've got NPR, you've got issues of culture and race, you've got media bias thrown out there, and certainly, Muslim issues and terrorism. It's got it all. And I think heading into the very end of a, hard-fought election season, it just offers great fodder for folks on the right to seize advantage of it. And you saw just that yesterday. Look, talking about defunding NPR has been a sort of old saw for the GOP going back for years now, and this sort of offered an opportunity for them to seize upon it anew. But you're right. The more profound issue is, where is the line? And, is there even this notion of sort of shared facts anymore, and what is news? It's really troubling. I think there's a good piece today by Brian Stelter in the New York Times getting at the fact that, you know, there are increasingly different versions of the news, and the Roger Ailes and Fox News version oftentimes is very different.
Jack Beatty, you're a news analyst. Are you going to be afraid to speak your mind?
Well, I think it's I think it's incumbent on someone like me to try to be. Well, let's put it this way. I think truth is neutral, and I think facts are neutral. People aren't. And I think that it's incumbent on anyone who has this sort of privilege to try to stick to the facts and the truth. Now, as Jonathan says, there are two different versions of the truth today, the way things are circulating, which is, I think, why, again, it's even further incumbent upon us to look at objective sources of truth, say the Congressional Budget Office or something that everyone accepts as a kind of umpire. But even with that, keeping the notion that that facts are neutral and troops are neutral and truth is neutral, I think it's I certainly feel that I have erred on the side of expressing opinions, and that's not right.
But don't people want opinions sometimes here too? I mean, Karen, let me put it to you. Juan Williams says, facts and truth, you know, the way I feel when I get on an airplane, that's a fact too. And we're supposed to be in this transparent era, where you sort of put it all on the table. On the other hand, as our listener said, if you substitute, blacks or Latinos on a subway in New York in urban garb, is that okay? I mean, Rick Sanchez, he's gone. Helen Thomas, she's gone. Now Juan Williams is gone. Are personal perceptions fair game? Personal feelings fair game when it comes to the whole picture of what's going on, Karen?
This is so hard. The fact is, I think that as a journalist, that my personal feelings, how I feel when I get on an airplane or go to the grocery store or whatever, they don't matter as long as there is nothing in my reporting and in my analysis that is compromised by my personal feelings. And, my work is out there every single day for people to make that judgment on their own. And I think that is really where the line is. I don't see, why I need to share my personal feelings about things as long as my work is out there. And this is not just, reporting. It's also, some of my stories are analytical. And as long as people can read my work and decide that, I am calling the balls and strikes as, fairly and as I see them.
Wow, it is tough, and there is a lot of furor over this. Let's hear from our listeners. Michael, first in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air.
Yes, to me, this is all about irrational fears. And Juan Williams certainly has the public airways to express his irrational fears about getting on an airplane. But if he does so in the guise of professional news commentator opinions, it's disingenuous for him to do so and not expect that he's going to be stoking the irrational fears of others. Now, this is not about the First Amendment and Constitution. The First Amendment guarantees, as says, the government cannot infringe upon people's free speech. But this is a news organization, Fox News, and Juan Williams can express his opinion as a news commentator, but he should not do so and not expect to face the consequences when his opinion is really expressing the irrational fears and designed to stoke the irrational fears of others.
But, Michael, what about if irrational fears are part of what's going on? I mean, Juan Williams is saying, look, I put it out there honestly. It's me. It's maybe not only Juan Williams.
Right.
But he went on to say to Bill O'Reilly, you know, wait a second, though. Yes, I have this feeling, but, you know, just the same way you can't look at Timothy McVeigh, you know, or others and say they were Christians, so all Christians are a menace. You know, that's not what he's saying. Bill, be careful. Don't do that.
But the focus should be on saying, yes, my fear, any reasonable, rational person should be able to say, look, if I say I'm going to get on an airplane and I see someone with a yarmulke and I'm afraid of that person, anyone can recognize that's an irrational fear. Let's talk about how do we reduce irrational fear in our society? How do we move forward in this country on a rational basis and looking at problems not out of irrational fear but out of rational desire to solve this country's problems.
Yeah, you got to be careful because it can look on the other side like sort of playing footsie with a religious war or something. Michael, thanks. Let's get another. Monty, Louisville, Kentucky. Monty, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks. I don't think they're irrational fears. I think the guy was rational. It's just a, you know, what's going on here is the media is having, you know, the left and the right, it's just an all-out war now.
Yeah.
I mean, I heard the ladies talking about how, you know, reporting everything to truthfully and everything like that. Well, I listen to NPR a lot. I'm a truck driver.
Yes, sir.
I listen to all kinds of talk radio. Well, I have yet to hear, you know, you're talking about the money situation. I've had yet to hear you guys talk about not knowing where the money's coming from for Republicans. Well, the last election, I mean, the credit card stuff with Obama, I mean, only 10% can, you only know where 10% of it came from, and the other 90%, they don't know where it came from. But I don't think this.
Well, I have to say, Monty, I mean, we've talked again and again about union money, about George Soros money here as well, but you're saying what? You see a slant in NPR.
A threat? I don't think it's a threat. I think that you guys lean to the left, Fox leans to the right, and I just wish everybody would get back to the days of the 70s and 80s, just reporting the news straight up.
Hey, bring on that time machine if you can find it, if it would still work. I mean, Jonathan Martin, there is something very sad about this
because Juan
may have been wrong or right, but he was a kind of bridge. I mean, NPR wouldn't let him call himself NPR news analyst on Fox for the last while here, but people
knew, and
people who watch Fox saw him, and he wasn't always, you know, out here in this dangerous territory. I'm sorry to see a bridge gone.
I do worry about what your caller said, and that is this sort of notion of how there are fewer and fewer news organizations doing sort of straight news, and how, you know, increasingly there's at least a perception of tilting to the right or the left. And what bothers me about it is that it's this notion of sort of losing shared facts and common truths. If we don't have that, then I think we're going to be in a world of hurt as a democracy. Look, it's fine to have voices and opinions out there, and, you know, the more the merrier. But I think it's important to retain a sort of press corps that is dispassionate, detached, neutral, objective. Those things matter. And I think it's important to readers and listeners to sort of have that out there doing reporting. You can have commentators and opinion folks, you know, picking up the reporting of others to sort of, you know, do their own riffs. But I think the sort of substance, the raw materials, if you will, of the news should still be reported by folks who have a sort of down-the-middle, detached perspective.
But that line between analyst and pundit and everything else that inhabits our sort of news universe these days, very tough one. Let's get more listeners. Omaha, Nebraska. Deborah, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a comment on Juan Williams.
Mm-hmm.
I listen to him on NPR and on Fox News.
Okay.
He's credible. He's excellent. I have to say that I do think it's reasonable for NPR to fire him because all of us are trying very hard not to be afraid of anything or anyone. But there are people who wear different clothes and different, you know, depending on who you are, the person who
right.
sits next to you on the freeway or the subway may or may not bring fear. And to be able to equate all Muslims with this whole fear thing, that's inappropriate. That's over the line. That was personal. It's way too big for him to get away with being able to say that.
Deborah, I know exactly what you mean there, and I appreciate your call. I mean, Jack, when I listened to this, what Juan's saying, and then I'm thinking of, you know, a lot of Muslims I know, and thinking of, gosh, is Juan really afraid of them? If they've got a headscarf on and he gets on the plane with them, and that's a rough place to begin. I mean, they're fellow Americans, and they didn't all bring down towers on 9/11 by any means, or even come close to supporting that.
Oh, certainly. But you know, I at least sense what was. I think I sense part of what was happening there. He was trying to get to his. It sounds to me as if he was trying to get to his civics lesson, which was to tell Bill O'Reilly, look, we can't have these kinds of categorical judgments about people. That is irrational. Everybody's rights have to be respected. We can't judge, you know, from one lunatic to an entire group. But to get there, he sort of went through the qualification. You know, even at the level of my feelings, I sometimes react this way.
Right.
Intellectually, Bill, I know that the principle of public policy should be this. So I think that he, you know, his desire to kind of not trump O'Reilly or not, you know, seem to be righteous, I think that was involved here, too. He wanted to be a good guest, to play along, to...
I know what you're feeling, but, Bill.
I know what you're feeling, and I feel it myself, but... And the but got lost here, I think.
One more call before the break here. Murfreesboro, Tennessee. John, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I was real quick. I understand what he is saying on the issue. The problem I have, and I think a lot of people do, is the platform he chose to do it on. You know, it's widely known that a lot of people feel that that station itself incites anger and incites fear.
You're talking Fox News here.
Sure. And, okay. You know, if he chooses that platform to express his statements, I would say he does it on NPR. I mean, that's not always popular thing to say, and maybe it brings a different perspective if he's brave enough to do it on a station or a group of people who may not feel that way. I think it would be better if he would have done it on that platform. It would have brought more credibility, as opposed to doing it on a platform where it's traditionally inciting a lot of fear, a lot of anger, and I think a lot of people just don't take him seriously when he does it on that.
John, you make a strong point. We're coming up on the break here, but I appreciate your calling on that. I mean, Jonathan Martin, it's difficult to dance on these two platforms, and you hear John's view of the Fox News platform. Others have their own of the NPR platform, but to dance on both, harder and harder.
It really is. You know, I think increasingly people are getting their own version of reality and sort of it's reminiscent of those childhood books about choose your own adventure. Well, now it's choose your own facts. And so if you are somebody that leans to the left, you can, you know, watch some cable networks, perhaps listen to certain programs on NPR, have your views reinforced. On the right, it's Fox News and some websites. But again, where is this notion of shared facts? I think it's a troubling trend.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, French riots continue. One French woman here says she fears the latest delay of the retirement age is just the beginning.
I know that for now it's 2 years, but it's going to be four years and then 6 years, and it's always like that.
The NFL cracks down hard on flagrant helmet hits, their support and resistance. Here's Chicago Bears linebacker Lance Briggs.
We're a bunch of grown men running at each other at full speed. What do you expect? You know, the plays aren't made in the NFL from being nice. Plays are made in the NFL from being violent.
And a Sesame Street video goes viral. This song, meant to encourage young black girls to feel good about their hair, quickly racked up over 500,000 hits on YouTube.
Don't need a trip to the beauty shop, 'cause I love what I got on top. It's curly and it's brown and it's right up there. You know what I love, that's right, my hair. I really love my hair.
It's right up there. Looking at a week in the news, campaign fever, don't ask, don't tell. Juan Williams, we've seen, we'll talk about more on Monday. Jonathan Martin is here, senior political writer at Politico. Karen Tumulty from The Washington Post is here, our own Jack Beatty. Of course, the judge said no to don't ask, don't tell. Then, after an emergency request from the Justice Department in Washington, a higher court comes in and says it's still on. Here's senior White House advisor Valerie Jarrett on CNN yesterday explaining why the Obama administration asked for a stay of a judge's order that halted the military's don't ask, don't tell policy on gays, despite the fact that the president has said he does not support the policy.
The president has been very clear that while he's president, he intends to end Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The Defense Department is going through a process now to begin to prepare for rolling it back. But it is a law, and we are a nation of laws. It was passed by Congress, and so we are looking for Congress to repeal it. Until Congress repeals it, the Justice Department is doing what it is required to do, and that is to defend the laws of the land.
Not everybody was happy with that. Here's Dan Choi, former infantry officer in the Army who served in the Iraq War, has been a leader in the campaign against the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. Yesterday morning on CNN, a visibly angry Lieutenant Choi responded to Valerie Jarrett's statements about the Obama administration's stance.
Valerie Jarrett said that gay people, some of us should try to understand the politics and the situation and that we are a nation of laws. Well, we understand that. We don't need a lecture from Valerie Jarrett on that. Civics, day one, American government, checks and balances. When Congress enacts a law that's unconstitutional, whose job is it to strike it down? The courts. I understand the judicial branch is now the only branch of government that is filling its mandate to the Constitution. But, and that the president is not able to do that upsets me. I'm resentful.
Dan Choi, he and a lot of others resentful. The court's all over this thing this week. Karen Tumulty, what do you make of what's going on here? It's kind of taken a back seat in the politics, at least as far as I've seen out on the hustings. But here's the president saying he's against it, but then, you know, pushing the Justice Department to get the change stopped, at least for now.
Yeah, it's a really difficult spot, I think, especially at a moment where the Democrats need their base to be motivated. And it almost reminds me of the situation that the president has with Latinos, many of whom remember his promise that he would reform immigration laws if he were elected, and they see that it hasn't happened yet. So, again, I understand the legalities of this argument, and I understand what it is that the Solicitor General does for a living. But the president is caught, I think, in the politics here between having to try to keep his base, which includes a lot of gay Americans, motivated, and at the same time to, you know, not alienate a lot of people who, and particularly commanders in the military, who don't want to see this move too quickly.
Jonathan Martin, what's your sense of the administration's argument that this was legislated, it needs to be unlegislated? Could it just have gone on the court ruling? Could they have let it go at that? Is there an operational? Would there have been a problem with that?
Oh, I think there's some politics here that may shock you guys. but in this sense, the president's got enough challenges right now from the right and from the sort of center right. And I think this is a matter of not wanting to inflame voters even more who were sort of conservatives or traditionalists. The lesson has plainly been learned from Bill Clinton's experience in 94 to try to stay away from the cultural hot buttons. And it's not just gays in the military. Look at what he's done on guns. Have you heard a word from this president on gun control during the course of the past 18 months? He's trying to sort of mitigate those issues. Now, it hasn't really helped that much because obviously conservatives are up in arms over even more fundamental issues regarding the role of government. But this, I think, is illustrative of a president who has tried to sort of dull the sharp edges of the culture wars, the sort of post-baby boomer president that he is. And I think that's part of the reason why going to the midterms, he has tried to avoid this issue. But there's no question about it. It's not going away. He's going to have to, at some point here, address it.
Jack Beatty, a sober presidential leadership example here, or copping out?
I think he's obliged to do what he did. That is, the president can't pick and choose what laws he's going to call to be enforced. Someone pointed out in the New York Times today, his president after him could say, I'm not going to go to court to defend the Obama health care because I don't like it. So he's obliged to do that. But he's putting an awful lot on the idea that the Senate is going to act in the lame duck session. Well, when the Senate comes back, because of the peculiarities of election laws in different states, there are going to be three new senators who are going to be voting. Even the rest of them have to wait till January. Senators from Illinois, West Virginia, and Delaware. Well, it's pretty clear in Delaware that's going to be a Democratic vote. We don't know about the other two. And so it could well be that the Democrats can't, either break a Republican filibuster, or that there won't be enough Republicans coming to them to break the filibuster, and that legislatively this won't happen, which will leave it all up to the courts. And I think I just worry about people who are now, I've been reading, people have been going to recruiting sergeants and recruiting places and saying, I am gay and accept me. And they've been taken in. And I think, as Secretary Gates has warned, if the courts rule the other way, these people are going to be really in jeopardy.
Woody in Charlottesville, Virginia. Woody, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hey, guys. Well, I've got a couple just quick key points. Number one, with all the other things going on in America right now, mm-hmm. the don't ask, don't tell thing is really small potatoes. Mm-hmm. Now's not the time to make that argument. And it's another one of those if it ain't broke, don't fix it kind of things. There's not just masses of openly gay people just trying to join the military complaining that they can't do it.
Though a fair number turned out last week when the military said they'd take them, and we know in the ranks of the military, obviously, from all the people who stand up or get kicked out, there are plenty of gays serving.
And nobody's mad about that. And now you do have, and I'm not one of these folks, and I'm not saying that there's a large number of them, but mm-hmm. there are people in the military that don't tolerate homosexuality, and now all you're doing is setting folks up to get themselves hurt. And another thing you've got to worry about is America's still in combat here. You still have soldiers on the front lines facing bombs and bullets every day, and the last thing they need is their focus to be taken away from that and focused on whether or not somebody next to them is gay.
So move it on down the road, and that's okay with you. We've got it, Woody. On the other hand, you've got people upset at the same time. Appreciate your call. James in Louisville, Kentucky. James, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you all doing today?
Pretty well. What do you see?
Well, what I see is, having served in the military and having worked along the rank and file of individuals, there are a lot more homosexual individuals who are very open about their practices within the military. It's a very selective enforcement of don't ask, don't tell on the status quo. What the concern is with a judicial decision over a legislative decision is it doesn't allow for time to be taken into consideration. If you take a look at the current deployment cycles we have going on, where you have platoons of men, maybe 18 or 19 individuals isolated out in the middle of an area miles away from the nearest FOB, what you have to think is that you don't want any hate crimes or discrimination to occur, because then it really reflects poorly on the military.
Yeah.
It needs to be a gradual laxing of those laws as we see it right now.
So you say do it, but do it gradually? Is that it?
Yeah, I think that's one possible solution. But I do think that, like I said, the military is a microcosm of society itself. So while 98% of the military would be open to the idea, you still have 2% who may act poorly towards the decision.
James, I appreciate your call. Jack, you're going to have people who feel like they've been waiting since the Clinton mm-hmm. years. And as you say now, with maybe big GOP numbers coming in, could be a long time again.
It could well be. And, one caller said, well, we don't have numbers of people clamoring about this. No, but over the years, according to what I've read, 13,000 people have lost their place in the military. This is one area where there's been just a real shift in public opinion. I think, I haven't looked lately, but somewhere like 75% of Americans favor this now. That's really quite a dramatic shift from 1992-93. And I think that shows that quite apart from politics, since this hasn't been a big issue, the society changes. People's perceptions change. We're not a static entity here. And there's just something encouraging about that. I don't mean just because of the direction of it, but because of the fact of it, that hardened attitudes, as people change, those attitudes, as experience changes, those attitudes can change too.
I want to look across the pond for just a minute. Plenty of stuff in the U.S. this week, but we had the riots in France. We've talked about them, but also this big move. And Jonathan, Karen, I'm curious how you see it resonating or not in U.S. politics, but Great Britain is moving to really cut its government spending in a very, very significant way, not token by any means. Here's the British Prime Minister, Conservative David Cameron. He was harangued and hurrahed in London's House of Commons this week, but he talked about the United Kingdom's $131 billion spending cuts, largest since World War II, equivalent of something like, half a trillion in the U.S. budget, saying they were essential to tackle that country's big, big deficit.
I take the view we've got to do everything we can to get our people into good and well-paid jobs. But I have to say, if we don't tackle the deficit, every job in this country is at threat. That's the point. But we are not doing this. We are not doing this because we want to. There is no ideological zeal in doing this. We are doing this because we have to.
We're doing this because we have to. Did that echo what you've been hearing out on the stump, Karen Tumulty, or something else?
Well, this is very much the argument that you're hearing on the stump, but it is not an argument that a lot of economists agree with. It is, while I think pretty much everyone agrees that, you know, in the long term, countries, including our own, do have to get their deficits under control, that sharp cuts in government spending right now, and in this case, what you're talking about, laying off 500, close to half a million
public
government workers in England, it would actually have the opposite effect, that it would actually, shrink the economy.
Resident here, Jonathan Martin, this is the home of Keynes himself, and they're going the other way. They're saying, we're going to bite this bullet right now, big time.
Oh, I think it may be some foreshadowing of a coming austerity era here in this country. I mean, we're grappling with our own sort of looming crisis here when it comes to baby boomers and their entitlement expenditures. So I think we're going to sort of face this debate. But what is so striking, and Karen alluded to this, but is just how much we are still in both parties kicking the can down the road when it comes to some of these questions. Yes, the Republicans are running against spending. There are a few examples, but a lot of the candidates out there on the GOP banner are avoiding answering hard questions as to what they would actually cut and how they would address entitlements. It's good and fine to point out some of the most egregious examples of earmark excess, you know, the rainforest and in Iowa or what have you. But earmarks are a fraction of the federal budget deficit. The big, big problem, of course, is with the entitlements. That's what's on the horizon for us. And we're not hearing from either party a lot of answers about how we're going to address the issue. I think that's going to be one of the dominant questions in the years ahead. And at some point, the candidates are going to have to actually take tough votes.
Jack Beatty, it's going to be really interesting to watch simultaneous experiments going on in different countries almost side by side. I mean, I don't know what the U.S. will do. I don't know what France will do. But we see what the U.K. is doing, and it's pretty stark. Now the whole world will see what happens.
Yeah, someone was saying, well, the British are looking to us to sustain demand. Well, that's not happening here. Our consumers are out of it and remain out of it. You know, to me, the resonant fact here is the cut in public employees. And look at the front page of the Wall Street Journal today, that even with all the talk of the Chamber of Commerce and Karl Rove's group and so on, what's the big spender in this campaign? The Public Employees Union, AFSCME. And why are they spending? Because they see what's happening in Britain, a half a million people, public employees, losing their jobs. And, the Republicans charge that the stimulus has been all about the Democrats paying off their interest groups in the states. $160 billion went to the states to sustain public employment. Now, those are teachers and firemen and so on, but they're also union members. And so it was the Republicans say the Democrats were paying off. Well, the AFSCME is paying out big time to try to prevent more of that from happening next year. It seems to me they're fighting against the tide because the fiscal conditions are such that I can just imagine more and more taxpayer rebellion.
Against the tide or just fighting? I mean, as you say, lots of corporate money coming in. And then this amazing story this week of Google with its, what do they call it, the double Irish, Dutch sandwich, tax evasion kind of overseas, paying way less than they might have in this country. That's amazing in itself. Karen, I want to come to you on Clarence Thomas's wife, Virginia Thomas, and her call to Anita Hill this week. I think to many people that seemed just out of the blue, but you did some interesting reporting. It's not the first time. I mean, Ginny Thomas, who's become quite prominent in her own right, seems not to be able to let go what happened with Anita Hill 2 decades ago.
Yeah, and it was really – it's. I think everyone is still trying to answer the question, what was she thinking? But this is not the first time that she has called up sort of out of the blue. We had a
people,
situation
– people, not Anita, but others.
Right, right. In fact, we had a situation here in the Washington Post where about 10 years ago, a reporter wrote a story about a man who was falsely accused of a sexual crime and – as he got a call from Ginny Thomas. So, it is sort of paradoxic that it comes at the moment when she's stepping out and establishing her own identity.
Her own identity with liberal, Liberty Central, I guess it's called, and its own anonymous funding. Yet another facet on that picture. Wow, what times, what times. Listeners, we will, again, look at the Juan Williams firing in more depth again on Monday. It's a big issue, and we know it. We will come back to it. Karen and John, I'm really grateful to you guys for being with us today. Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent with the Washington Post. It's always great to have you. Thank you very much today, Karen.
Thank you so much.
And Jonathan Martin, senior political writer at Politico. Jonathan, thanks for joining us from Washington.
Thanks so much for having me, and kudos to your deft handling of a tough issue, Tom.
Well, let's all move forward here. Jack Beatty, thanks so much. Listeners, thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.